Hello.
Yeah.
There he is.
I like it. I like the headphones. That's the other thing. I really, you know, when I have guests and, well, you want to wear the headphones? Like, do I need them? Yeah, you do. So you know how far to get away from the mic, you dummy. It's amazing how many people just, who are professional entertainers, are like, they're over here. And I can't. And I'm like, you know, can we just, I mean, it's right there in front of you. Just get up.
Hi, I'm Chick McGee, and we're off the air.
Hey! It's kind of a hoedown.
Bright as the sun, when the night is cold. Bright as the day.
Thank you for downloading the Off the Air podcast. I'm Chick. That is Jess. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
That's Jason. And our guest today is unbelievable. I call him the godfather of podcasting.
The podfather.
The podfather. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Maron joins us today. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Chick. I'm not crying.
Why are you rubbing your face?
I put on lotion. I put lotion on my face, and I think it's got a little sunblock in it, just enough to blind me if I rub my eyes.
Well, don't do that.
It's too late. It's in there, Chick. It's in there. So let's pretend like I'm weepy right at the outset.
Leave yourself alone.
I think it'll go well.
The only person who cries on this podcast is me.
That's
true. And today might be a day. I'm not sure. I'm just really glad you're here.
I'm glad I'm here. It's nice to see everybody. There's no reason to cry. I guess if we get into it, I can find a couple.
Sure.
I think I've cried on my podcast, but I've held it in.
Yeah.
I get myself emotionally engaged with the story. Weird times I cry. Where you feel choked up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And usually in real life, you're like, well, we got to shove this feeling down. No reason to have this publicly with anybody. I mean,
never.
Yeah, unless I'm trying to apologize for making someone else cry. That's when tears are necessary.
Date of your first podcast?
September 9th, I think, 2007.
Wow.
Is that right? No, 2009. September 2009.
Okay.
Was the first month. I'm not sure exactly what the date is. Was that a quiz? I'm not good. If you asked me my girlfriend's birthday, I'd be hard pressed.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's no good.
Oh, my God.
You're really having trouble with your eyes.
I'm going to be all right.
You need a wash?
We can get you a wash. An eye wash?
No,
yeah. You have those little things, little cups that you put over your...
Jess, do you have some sort of cosmetic eye wash?
I'm all right. I'm going to be all right. It's good. It's good. It's got me into the moment. Wow.
Of all the comedians that I know and of all the comedians I've seen and thought about, hey, he'd be a good podcaster.
Mm.
I think you probably... Because your stand-up lent itself to the podcast medium, don't you think?
I don't know. I when I got into it, to podcasting, I do long-form comedy. I do talk. But I think it really came down to the fact that I did do some radio. And I wouldn't say I was a radio veteran by any, whatever the word that goes in there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good with adages and sayings. But is there any account? Any account?
Is
that stretch of the imagination.
Stretch of imagination is good.
You. Yeah.
But I did a couple of years on these kind of mics, and I loved it. And
Air America? Is that right?
I was on Air America, and then I was fired there a few times. And ultimately what happened is when I went back to do the streaming video show and got fired again, they didn't kick us out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
They gave there's the Achilles heel of the progressives is that we fired him, but they're on contract for a month. Let's let them stay in the building with their security guard. Yeah. So clearly not radio people. You're off the air. The mics go down. Thank you very much. Here's your box.
Get
See
the
you
hell
later.
Out. Yeah.
But we started doing it, and once I learned. It was really about radio. It wasn't about comedy for me. It was really about the fact that I found a freedom on these kind of mics.
Really?
And that I knew, I really set out towards the end of doing radio to try to take the challenge of being alone on the mic. That once I cross that boundary where, working with a crew is one thing and you can always divert. But once you sort of get that opportunity, it's like you got to fill in for somebody. It's 3 hours. It's just you. Oh, shit.
I couldn't do that.
Right.
I couldn't do that. And I've been in radio since 1976. I couldn't do it by myself anymore, I don't think.
It's a weird thing. But once I cross that line where I'm like, I can do this. I can talk out into nothing and not feel like I'm talking into nothing. Like I can have that conversation on this kind of mic. I was like, well, shit, this is great. And that was really the impetus. Comedy was not even a consideration in terms of what I was going to do with the podcast that much. I just wanted to have the freedom of mind and the freedom of being able just to talk.
So were there any the frame of the podcast, was it out there at all when you started?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't listen to them. But when we were, you know, by the time we had finished Air America, when I got fired that last time, I had nothing. My career was garbage. I couldn't get booked. My manager had hung me out to dry. I was in the middle of the second divorce. I was broke. And I knew that there were dudes doing it. I knew Kevin Smith was out there. I knew Pardo was out there. I knew Jimmy Dore was doing it. Mm-hmm. And Todd Glass, a few others. But I didn't listen to them, but I knew it was an option. So I said to my producer, let's try it. Let's just, we'll figure out what we're going to do. You figure out how to upload it, and we'll just commit to a schedule.
That sounds incredibly familiar. I was just going to say, because our big hurdle was, because I do the morning show and everything, my big was actually, this is going to sound weird because of what I do, but making it tangible somehow. If I could get that first one going and make that appointment in my head, okay, I'm going to do this, okay. Then you can start rolling and kind of get a framework and try to go with it. Yeah,
yeah, just write it out. I mean, that's right. The most important thing. If we're if there's podcast 101, it's just that if you don't put them up regularly,
right,
no one's going to build up the habit. That if you're like, right. I did one and then nothing happened, and we're thinking about doing another one. Maybe if I can get the guys together, it's like, well, don't bother with the second one.
Right. Yeah.
You got to have a schedule, because we knew from radio that what's the least we can do. Not the least, but you won't want to do every day because you want it to maintain some uniqueness. You got to decide whether you want to do radio, because there's a lot of podcasts that are radio
every day. Yeah, right.
And but also format wise.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no shortage of crack drive time crews out on the airwaves. I mean, if you're gonna take your freedom and just be Joey the douchebag and Mindy, you know what I mean. I just made those up.
You're not going to change your name to Mindy, Jess. It's okay.
Okay.
No, I'm not knocking you guys. I haven't listened to the show, but maybe I am.
It's fine.
No. But I'm saying that, twice a week, that's enough to build an audience. Mm-hmm. And then we just started doing it. And at the beginning, it wasn't an interview show, really.
No, at the beginning, it was. I don't know if you're aware of this. Maybe you are. At the beginning, it was you apologizing to your guests for you being a dick in the past. Did you know that?
I ran out of those people. Finally. Yeah, that's mission complete.
Finally.
There's a couple I still need to apologize to, but I haven't gotten the fortitude. I have not let go of the resentment. But yeah, there was a lot of that. But there was also third acts with guests that were not real or might have been real. We were doing some Kaufman-esque kind of things with third guests when I first moved back to L.A. At the beginning, I had people hanging around in the room. I had my buddy Matt. I was doing phone interviews, which I refuse to do now at all for long-form interviews. I won't do it.
Oh, that's right. Okay. I remember.
Like Jeff Ross was on the phone, and Cross was on the phone. And I had Matthew was sometimes hanging around. And sometimes I'd have a couple of guests in the room. Mm-hmm. And then once I got to L.A., I was like, well, it just kind of evolved into the interview show.
Mm-hmm.
This is nothing like a drive-time radio show.
So by doing the Air America show for a while, did that kind of set you up for what you didn't want to do?
Absolutely. I made a very clear decision never to do politics again, and never to cut my audience in half. Or
I agree.
Are you making a decision how serious you're going to be?
No, because I just had to let that go. When you talk on these mics, I mean, I will have a free thought. I improvise all the monologues. I don't even outline them. And I'll be driving for funny. But if funny doesn't happen, I'm not going to be hung up on it.
Okay.
Because I think that part of the beauty of conversation is that sometimes funny is just a place you're going to go to, well, this is getting too uncomfortable. And with radio, I mean, you can make it. Why not let it be a little awkward? Why not let it be a little uncomfortable?
Let me tell you, I have the Marc Maron app. I don't have the premium app yet. I haven't checked that out. What is the premium app?
Premium app, if you get the free app, and then you can only get the most recent 50 podcasts on the free app. And then if you upgrade, you can stream all 380.
Maybe I have the premium app.
You must.
I do. Because my favorite one, and I've been next to talking her into doing this and knowing she would be good at it.
I haven't proven it today, but I'm not bad.
Do I need to give you some more room? Am I?
I'm excited to the point of silence.
Well, I hope I'm paying off. I hope this is paying off.
We're as a podcast, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yesterday was great because it was, two episodes ago, it was just the three of us, and we had a really good podcast. And then yesterday, we had a podcast with what we would call a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
But podcast before that, or in the middle of that, there was Jeff Garland.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, we've talked about this.
Yeah, we talked about it off the mic.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He tore me apart, and we explained.
Oh, goodness.
Wait, that,
you think so?
Is that a little strong? I haven't listened
Jason,
to it yet.
Jason, you think that he tore him apart.
I don't think he tore him apart. He gave him a really hard time just because, and we've already gotten a little bit of feedback from people that said a few things.
That weren't happy?
In his defense. Of course, they're going to defend Chick.
But we later went, that night,
but it wasn't that bad.
We saw Jeff
And that's what he does.
And that's what he does. Yeah. That's what Jeff does. You guys already talked about that.
Well, a little bit.
No, Jeff is going to be on Mark's new
I love him. I think he's great.
I still love him.
Yeah. We don't have to be diplomatic here. You're allowed to publicly not like somebody. Okay. You're just going to have to take the hit for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, no, that's true. No, I like Jeff. I think, but I don't. But and he said he's going to come back and do another podcast with us. And
Jeff is a big personality. Yeah, he's on one episode of the show, of the Marin show on IFC. He played himself as a podcast guest, and we had some other business. Some of the people playing themselves are integrated into the story a bit, and some just are just almost like Larry Sanderish. You kind of they're just there for a few minutes and then gone.
Right.
But he was he was good to work with. I like Jeff, but he's a lot to deal with, and he was busting your balls, right?
he was busting.
And due to I think something you can relate to, and I need to talk to you about this further.
Possibly, on the mic?
Possibly at dinner. But my emotional instability and my drive to be better, when that is challenged, I immediately melt. I'm just like, yeah, you're right. I suck. Oh, my God.
Oh, see, I go the other way, and I will defend myself. I will. As soon as that gets hit with me, my first my default is like, well, fuck you. I mean, what are you kidding me? See, I celebrate my insecurity with anger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I get my
puff up.
Yeah,
and
I puff up, and I'm like, no. But lately, if there is a mid. There's a middle
healthy ground, right?
I don't know if it's healthy, but there's some place in between fuck you and I suck that it sounds a little more like this. Huh. Yeah, I guess, maybe I do that a little bit. You know, that's kind of interesting.
And I'm okay with doing that.
Well, not necessarily. Well, I mean, I don't know if you need to be okay with it, but, the I suck thing is a little hard for people because I've learned over time that if you see somebody in a fight with themselves, it's really hard to step in.
Wow.
So true.
Yeah, it is.
It's like, I don't know. Is it right for me? This guy's really taking himself down.
Yeah.
I don't know who's going to win here, but I know one part of him's going
to
lose.
Well, this is a great podcast because next to being in a fight with myself, these two are probably the closest to me, friends and everything that I have. And they try to help and they try to step in, but I'm going to remember what you just, it is
that's
hard.
That's huge. I mean, that's huge for me to look at you and go, I tried to step in.
I tried to step
in. For five years, I tried to step in and make it better.
Yeah. And
or break up the fight.
Bless your heart. thank you for trying.
You're welcome.
And how silly of me to think that, well, why can't you fix this? This is great.
We're going to fix it by the end of this show.
No, I'm good.
Well, Mark, here's what he
tried.
Said at the end of Jeff Garland. Here's Elwin. Thanks for coming. I'm going to walk out in traffic.
Yeah.
That's where he ended
That's
it.
The end of it. Yeah, that's how I said.
Yeah.
That was the end of it.
I think, I don't know what happened to me along that stuff because I used to really beat the shit out of myself. But it was innate. It was deep. I didn't even know I was doing it. And I used to think, well, this is the way that I stay on top of things. I would rationalize it somehow that, like, you know, if I'm saying I suck, it's only, you know, in the service of making me better. But really, you know, if that's your attitude and you keep moving forward with that, it'll sort of define you. And ultimately, I tried for years to make bitterness appealing. And quite frankly, bitterness is just amplified self-pity. So, you know, if you take away the anger that is in bitterness,
right,
all you got is a guy up there saying, you know, well, how come I'm not better? Where's mine? I'm an idiot, you know. Yeah. And it's not, you know, people don't know what the hell to do with that. It's not entertaining. They feel bad for you. But in terms of, I think the key here is humility, Chick. It's humility.
All right. All right, Mark.
Yeah, there is a difference between self-pity and humility.
And modesty.
Modesty's tricky.
Tricky.
But like, I just knew when my heart got broke the second time, when my second wife left me,
mm-hmm,
because I was an asshole.
Right.
Because I was a spiraling, self-pitying, insecure piece of shit.
I'm familiar with all this.
Right. But when she left, somehow or another, that heartbreak... Yeah, when you're heartbroken, I mean, you don't know what the hell you're going to do. And my career was in the toilet. So there was a lot of things going on. So then you start saying, like, I should walk out into traffic. I should just fucking end it. I don't know what the hell's going to happen. There's no more plan Bs. I'm in this thing and it's over. You know, that's a horrible moment when you're in your late 40s or however old you are, when you decide whatever you've been doing all your life is shit. And you're like, well, fuck this. I could always... Oh, my God. There's nothing in that folder?
There's nothing in the folder.
It's a tough one. So then you start thinking, like, well, I guess I'm just going to kill myself. I don't know when. I'm not making plans, but I don't see how else this is going to end.
Yeah.
And that's just pride being a bitch. So ultimately, once you get through that, you're like, all right, I had my ass handed to me. But on another level, I'm now at ground level. I'm at the base level of me. This is who it is.
Right.
So what are you going to be, a sad fuck your whole life, or are you just going to be
How's that working for you so far, Chick? Not real well. Yeah, the sad fuck part. I mean, it's doing okay. I have some a career in quotes or whatever professionally.
Yeah. But the career's got nothing to do with anything. It's like, are you going to be the sad fuck? Are you going to be the angry fuck? Or are you going to take the hit, squirt out a few tears, ride it out until the pain fades, and thank that bitch for handing you your ass?
Thank her.
Yeah.
You can go ahead and thank me.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
I don't know. You know, at some point, I'm not saying I don't resent it, but there's something about taking responsibility for your part of the bullshit.
Oh yeah.
And really doing it, that it's freeing. You know, life is short, man, and that's a hard thing to realize. You know, once you sort of get on with it, that like, hey, I'm more than halfway done. You know.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, how do I want to ride out the rest of this? You know, am I doing? I'm not saying living life to its fullest, or you know, gee, I haven't parasailed. But literally, like, do I want to try and sort of wrench some joy and peace of mind out of this last quarter?
Yeah.
Or do I want to just fight this ridiculous fight with me, and at the end of it, when I'm on my deathbed, go, yep, I knew I would lose.
Yep, yeah. I knew I was ready to lose.
Did you have a moment where you kind of gave yourself some credit? You're like, all right, I've been a comic for 20 years. I have 20-some years. You have all these experiences. You have these friends. You have these relationships. And then that turned into the podcast in a way? I mean,
no, I wish it was that, you know, because when the shit really hit the fan, the problem with being insecure and being, you know, self-hating or self-judging or whatever it is that you're not able to really give yourself credit, you know, because what's in the way of that is sort of, you know, why am I not in a different place? I mean, and you can only get to a certain place with that until you're sort of, you either think you're suck. There's only so long you can say that people misunderstand you. Like, you know, people just don't get me. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, like, well, four people do, and they're sad too. And I don't know if I can make a living off these four people necessarily.
Well, you did that for a long time in your career. You weren't getting the crowds. You weren't, at some point you were, but yeah, then it kind of...
It just wasn't done. I wasn't done. I was not, you know, I was driven by spite. You know, my career early on was driven by the fact that I had good management, and because of my anger and my way of thinking, I was unique enough to be reckoned with.
Right.
But I mean, literally most of the calls to my manager early on was like, why the fuck is he doing that? How come I'm not on that show? If that guy can get on that show, I should be able to get on that show. Make some calls.
Yeah.
And, you know, that management, that got bad. But but that was what it was driven by. And to be honest with you, when I started the podcast, I was relatively broken guy. I mean, I was really, there was no way for me to hide from the fact that my shit had not panned out. You know, I got paid well a couple of times, but I was not getting any traction with other humans you know, in terms of being in show business or being somebody that does something that people would pay to see or pay to listen to.
Right.
And I had to accept that. At some point, you just got to say, like, well, you know, all I can do now is try to make it right. And that's sort of what started the podcast. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I knew I had complete freedom. And I knew I had these relationships with people that were, there was an image of me that a lot of times was something I inflated, which was, you know, he's kind of an asshole. He's difficult. He's aloof. He's cocky. And
Moody.
Yeah, all that stuff. It may have been true, but not to the degree that I thought, because I'm a self-hating guy. And if your brain is self-hating, right, you're going to look for things within you, right, to use as a bat. You know, it's like, right, okay, I'm a dick. I'll use that bat today.
Well,
you know,
and the worst thing is that when you have this opinion of yourself and someone else goes, you know, you are kind of moody. And they don't mean it like you're hearing it.
Right.
But it's like, oh, my God.
It's confirmation.
Yeah, I am. Oh,
see,
Jesus.
That proves it.
I told you. Yeah. We're fucked.
Yeah, yeah. Ship sinking.
Everybody out except me. I'm the martyr. Get the cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah, you got the martyr thing. I don't have that as much. A little more lately. That's a weird thing.
Grown into it.
I have. Well, you know, you know, if you're going to use the recovery paradigm, you know, at some point, you know, either you're going to be the drunk, or you're going to be the one that takes care of the drunk. You're going to be the drunk, or you're going to be the codependent. So, you know, drunks usually find codependents to drain of their life essence. That you just feed on them, and then the codependent is feeding on their desire to try to control your fucking ridiculous behavior, and that thing just burns down. But I've always been the other side of it.
Oh my God! Yeah, she's the one who's always
this is that. That's our relationship.
That had been our. Well, I was codependent on her like crazy, and
she was your codependent.
I was sucking the life out of her.
She's trying to fix you.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And she was trying to fix. Yeah, and a lot of ways she still sort of is, but yeah. I'm not kind of.
We just don't live together.
We just don't live together. She's worried. She's concerned. But hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm gonna step in here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I missed the beat.
You know, but hang on just a second. I'm learning more, almost as much, if not more,
with
from this episode than
Dr. Will.
I love Dr. Will, but because Dr. Will is our psychiatrist.
Sure.
We had him on an episode, and we talked about the demise of our relationship. And I'm relating
so much with your wife.
No, with
this. Is this a romantic relationship?
It once was. We were engaged. Yeah.
Oh, you're a ballsy dude. Right, having her right here in the room and still working things out, that's beautiful. I didn't know that. I didn't get the press on that.
We didn't want you to get the press on that. We wanted you to.
You just wanted to stick me in the middle of your fucking problem?
Yeah, the whole time I'm thinking, oh, Mark knows.
It's a sandbag. No. Sandbag.
No, because everything that you've been saying up until this point totally applies to our relationship.
Oh, well, then I can tell you exactly what's going on.
Go ahead.
Because you're in the same relationship right now.
No, I'm in a different relationship now. But what I learned in the second one, and to address your question from earlier, not until the podcast started to, you know, people started to like it, but like it in a way that I never expected. Did I, you know, in the midst of all that divorce and all that horror and all the sort of desperate need to connect with other individuals on the mic, when I would bring people in, like, for a long time, I had become so cynical, and I'll get to you guys in a second. Mm-hmm. Okay. I had become so cynical that I could not find any humor. I had a hard time laughing at things. I was very preemptively defensive. I felt that I'd gotten the short end of the stick career-wise and that all my friends were succeeding. And I really couldn't get out of that. It's almost like your heart is a clenched fist. Mm-hmm. And when I got humbled, when I went broke, when that woman left me, and I loved her, and I did not see it coming. I was that much in denial. I thought that it would continue on, and when she just blindsided me by leaving me, and it went on for about a year, the 3 months trial separation, which just means, you know, I need more time to figure out how to leave you permanently. There's no, you know, that shit is bullshit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was really that juncture of like, am I going to be the guy that's like, you know, fuck women, or am I gonna take the hit? So the process of taking the hit and then being humbled, like I was a broken dude. So I would, I'd bring people in and I'd need to connect. I needed the podcast emotionally. Like I need, and people used to say, like, you know, you talk a lot about yourself. It's my show, you know, and that's how I'm going to connect with this person. I need help and celebrities are going to help me. That's the way that, but I didn't frame it like that. These were my friends. These were my peers. These were people that could talk about anything, and comics are. So once that conversation, once the dialogue of that show began to have an effect on people, I developed, there was a real sense of confidence happening, which I'd never experienced, mm-hmm. ever. Like, you know, I would get letters. It wasn't like, you know, your show's funny. It was like, wow, you really helped me. The emails I get are predominantly, you know, you helped me through a dark time. I didn't think other people felt the way I did, that I do. I didn't realize that guy was like that. That everyone's just a person. So the effect that the podcast was having was something beyond anything I could have expected, and I didn't have any expectations. And that sort of, like, I felt like finally after 25 years I was doing something relevant. I mean, it's not even being a star. You know, ultimately when you get old enough, all you want is not to die broke, and you hope to God you have insurance. I mean, that's really what it's going to come down to. It's like whoever I've got to support, myself and others or whatever, I hope I can do that and not die broke. And hopefully not alone, but you know, at the last minute, you're really on your own. But
thanks, Mark.
Yeah. Everyone dies alone.
Right.
That's a trip you make yourself. But with you guys, what happened to me and what it took a long time for me to understand in the second marriage, because I was a recovering guy. And, you know, I'd met that woman. I was married when I met my second wife. Mm-hmm. I was married to a woman that I shouldn't have married. You know, mm-hmm. I was an alcoholic, a drug addict, but I was managing for the most part. But I didn't have any real sense of self-awareness or any recovery. I'd been in and out of AA and whatnot a bit, but it never locked in. So what happened with me was I was literally in that first marriage laying in bed, you know, on coke, and she didn't know it. You know, with my heart pounding out of my chest, just, you know, sort of half praying to die because I didn't know how I was going to get out. So that was really the first kind of compression of the career. I wasn't doing nothing. My comedy career was sort of stalled. I was doing segments on a local TV show in New York City, and I was married, and I said, I thought to myself, well, I guess this is it. This is how regular people live. You just mm-hmm. suck it up, take the hit, do whatever you got to do to get by, and stay in it or die.
Mm-hmm.
And that was looking more attractive.
Right.
And my first wife was a good woman. She was all right. She was, you know, I just wasn't, you know, I shouldn't have married her.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with her about 8 years. So then out of nowhere, I meet this fucking beautiful, you know, geez. She was, you know, she was a comic. She used to be a model. She was just spectacular looking. I was like 35. She was 23. She came up to me, you know, at a comedy club. And she's like, you're Mark Maron. And I go, yeah. She goes, what happened to you? I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, you look like you're dying. I'm just a fan, and you know, you look like mm-hmm. you're in trouble. You know, and I'm like, what? No, I'm not. I'm all right. Who the fuck are you? And she was like, you know, well, you know, I can help you get sober if you want. I'm like, yeah, I know the God thing. You know, AA. Yeah, all right, whatever. Mm-hmm. But she was so fucking hot. I was like, I'm in. Yeah.
I'm in.
So to sort of get to where I'm trying to get is that, you know, I locked on to her. You know, she was going to get me sober. So I followed her around, and I thought she was stunning. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, it's like I'm getting sober, and I'm in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I left my wife, and I went with this girl. This poor 23-year-old girl had a big ball of unrecovered, angry Mark. Like, I don't think, like, and I've done this before, but not much. I don't think this is part of courting where you're yelling at a girl saying, like, are we doing this? Because I'm leaving her. Why are you crying? Are we doing it? I'm going to leave her. You in?
I guess so.
Good enough. I'm going to leave her.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's how that started. But the bottom line is she, you know, I did get sober. Like I did lock in with her, and she wouldn't have been with me if I wasn't sober.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'd go to meetings, we'd do all that stuff. And she really got me that first couple of years of how to think as a sober person. But the fact is I didn't address the fact that I replaced alcohol and drugs with her heart. So there's the problem is that you don't know that. But, you know, if you're taking care of your shit, you know, you shouldn't be sitting there with your wife or girlfriend or husband going like, I'm fucked. I'm an asshole. Because all you're doing is like, you know, come on. I want to take it out of you. Can you make me feel better? And then, you know, right when they make suggestions, you're like, no, you're not. It's not working. And they try the best they can. And no, not working. Sorry. And so what happens is that person eventually a codependent bottom, not unlike an alcoholic bottom, is they lose complete sense of themselves. They no longer, you know, things, you know, they start to drop things. They get in car accidents. They no longer have an anchor of who they are because they've just been depleted of it by your lack of responsibility for your fucking shit. And they just get drained and emptied and have no choice but to leave. They don't want to leave, but they have to save themselves. And that's what happens. I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. You've just, you've pinpointed it.
Well, now I'm going to cry. We can't all cry.
It's, no, okay.
It's one thing when a doctor says it. You
it's
know,
another thing when someone's experienced it.
It feels clinical.
Right.
But when someone who's been through it says it and who Chick respects and admires says it and you hit the nail on the head, it means even more, I think.
Yeah.
I am so sorry.
It's okay.
It's okay, you guys. I mean, this stuff is deal. It's workable stuff. You can come back from this stuff. You know, you really can. I know that you can. And you know, the thing is that we have these dialogues in our head that we can't stop. And the thing about this particular cycle is I don't know that I wouldn't have stopped it. This is what I was saying before about having your ass handed to you, is that I don't know that I would have had any fortitude to really think about this stuff had not that relationship exploded.
Yeah.
You know, to sort of take responsibility for it. And I'm not great at it, but you know, some of this stuff is, you know, if you are one of these people that does this, it really comes to, I started to see myself, you know, emotionally as a, you know, as a kid lost in a mall. You know what I mean? Like, I've spent my entire life going, Mommy! Mommy! Will you be my mommy? I don't know where she is. She wasn't that good anyways. Will you take care of me?
I don't really care where she was, but I know I'd like another one.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark, you are hitting all the... This is so revelatory and significant and... I mean, I love Dr. Will to death, like I said, but I had no idea this was coming. I knew that we've had the talk about your podcast before and how I identified with you. And
there are just certain things you're not going to get from other people. And your heart doesn't know that.
Right.
And the reason it doesn't know that is because it was denied you. And it was denied you at a time where you did not have any control over it. So... And that's just the reality, is that, you know, the immaturity of having, you know, that need or that, you know, I don't want to diminish it by saying it's an alcoholic or an addictive personality. But
It is.
It's part of it.
It's definitely part of it.
But right. Like in practical terms, because some people are like, you know, is alcoholism an addiction? Is it really a disease? Well, it is. And it's a disease that manifests itself psychologically, physically, in a lot of other ways. But for me, in this one particular area, you know, I realized that, you know, I was not, and, you know, and I don't, you know, whoever is listening to this, that's sort of like, hey, these guys ought to suck it up, can go fuck themselves. Now, the you know, the tough love doesn't work. It just makes aggravated bully grownups, you know. So the thing is that, you know, at some point you realize, well, you know, certain needs were not met for me at a time where I needed them to be met, but I had no control over it myself.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying that my parents were abusive or anything else. They were a little self-centered. They had no boundaries, and they were not, you know, not nurturing people. Not they could not be selfless enough to be effective parents or to enable me to have to separate and have my own sense of self.
Right.
So you kind of walk through life, you know, demanding things to be taken care of. You know, basic things. I don't feel good. Why? You know, and you know, when
you better make this better.
Right. Right. And when you're, you know, that's appropriate if you're four. But right. I mean, even at four, you know, a parent should say, well, what is going on with you? And you're like, well, Joey got a scooter and I want one.
Yeah.
And they should be able to say, well, we'll get you one for Christmas, or your dad can't afford it, or we'll try what we can. But, you know, life is tough, kid. Buck up.
This is all also because my grandchildren are visiting this year, and my youngest grandson is 2.5. And I swear to whatever God or thing you worship, he was in the kitchen today, and he wanted his mom's box of French fries.
Yeah.
And he was, mom, now, and I'm going... That is my grandson. He reminded me so much of me and now and wanting it and not thinking, you know what? It's okay. Mom can have her French fries. I'll get some French fries.
The difference
later.
Is he's
I'm good
two.
Right now. Exactly. and the difference is I'm 55 and I'm identifying with a 2.5-year-old, Mark.
That is it.
But it was with attention. I want your attention, and I want it right now, and I don't want anybody else to have it.
It was more about it. That is mine. Mm-hmm. I wanted her attention to the point where I don't want her to exist other than giving
for you.
Me
that's
attention.
Right. For him, that's yeah. right. And yeah.
But it's I grew up in a situation where it was my dad raised me, and he was there for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything wanted mm-hmm. me to be as well rounded as possible, and I was really fortunate. I was very fortunate, so I have very much a caretaker. I'm gonna fix it.
So it was the
I'll
perfect.
Make
it,
better.
It was the perfect.
It was the perfect storm.
It always is.
For a long time.
Are you kidding? With that thing that you have in your chest, you're gonna find what you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not good ways, but like, you know, like we find each other because, you right. know, there are matches for it. It's like it not like, you know, my heart is hungry.
But in my desire to get better, this happened. In her desire to get better, we had to break up. I mean, there's no way that she can constantly give people. And let's face it, I'm a guy you met in the bar. I mean, I'm not the person you're supposed mm-hmm. to be. You can be if you're in love with me and give me the proper amount of attention.
And it's too, I've cut off a bunch of relationships, a bunch of caregiver relationships. I have an uncle who is bipolar, and I've cared for him and taken care of him, and it's been exhausting.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I had to completely cut him off from my life, and it sucks.
And you did that on your own. My father's bipolar, and this is something that, you know, I'm not preaching program, but I mean, detachment. That's what they call detach with love mm-hmm. in the Al-Anon program.
Oh. Yeah.
The Al-Anon program is for people that love people like you. Mm-hmm. And
is it possible to change? Can I change?
Of course.
Can I be independent and happy with myself and not rely on somebody else to get their attention and feel
from yes, because what you learn to do is identify it. You know, if you can get out from under these kind of relationships that are ultimately bad for you, because, you know, they will enable you never to deal with it.
Right.
So, you know.
So this is a good thing that's happened.
It is.
We've always said that. But
this is the first time you've been in a relationship and you haven't had another relationship to replace it.
See, that's what I've also done too, Mark. It's like, okay, well, this is starting to suck and they're not giving me the attention I need, so I'm going to go find someone else. Her words, who will adore me.
Right.
And I'll be fine.
That's
right.
And
then when that person stops adoring me, I'll go to someone else who would. And it's just, I mean, I don't even know. I think I do, but I don't even know what a healthy give and take relationship. I see people in malls walking along.
Yeah, don't overestimate them.
I mean, I don't even know what
you're
a healthy,
fantasizing a little bit.
You just
sort of see people holding hands and staring out at the world blankly as they walk through, and like, how come I can't have that? you know those people. That could be a child molester. But, you know, look, I don't know. I struggle with it all the time. And, you know, I still have, you know, I have real anger problems. I have rage problems that, you know, I have to really be vigilant about. You know, with the codependent stuff, you know, I'm now with a girl that literally she works with autistic children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's a behavioral modification person. She, right. you know, she goes to school with an autistic kid. You know, and you know, she literally has said things to me like, you know, use your words.
Yep.
And she will not tolerate me acting like a child, you know, an emotionally disturbed child.
Yeah.
Because she'll literally just not engage with it. And I got two ways to go with that. I can either realize, you know, she's right. It's not her job. You know, what am I really feeling? How do I do this? Can I call somebody, you know, who you know, like someone in the program or whatever? You know, because these are all ism issues. But again, I'm not promoting that. You know, there's other ways to deal with it. But so like that has helped. But then I find that I've switched over. This is the problem with being a sober person, is that eventually once you get your alcoholism, you know, under wraps, you're going to find yourself to be the codependent person. Like now I'm with this girl that, you know, that keeps me, you know, in check, but, you know, has her own needs. And I'm completely sort of like, I don't want her to get upset. I better get her. What does she need? I mean, I'm preemptively thinking how she won't get upset. Like, I have become right. this weird kind of like, oh, maybe I should just pay her debt. You know, that kind of shit. Mm-hmm. And now I've got to figure out how to detach in that way. But this stuff, you know, self-parenting, you know, in a very real way, in a very basic way, you know, identifying the fact that, you know, a tantrum by a, you know, 5-year-old is annoying but appropriate. And a tantrum by a 50-some-odd-year-old person that has the same emotional drive, you know, the same emotional engine as that tantrum
yeah.
by a kid is disturbing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's scary. And I deal with that still, where I'm like, you know, recently, you know, we've gotten into these fights where she just walls up and, you know, and she engages with me. We'll yell at each other and then she'll just shut down. I'm sort of ashamed to say this, but I was at the edge of my bed, standing up, screaming, "I hate you! I hate you! I hate you!" Like that came out of my mouth
yeah.
as a 49-year-old man.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a 2.5-year-old grandson's what it is.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's what you're dealing with emotionally. So, I mean, can you get better? Yeah, take care of that kid.
Well, I'm trying.
All right.
It's kind of, I'm not
yelling at you.
I don't work well by myself, but I'm trying.
I don't either.
You know what I mean? I mean, I try to surround myself with, you know, whatever, but other friends or but it's just not, it's all hollow.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't have any, you know, I'm no wizard of this shit. I've got problems and, you know, I act out in different ways. You know, there's a million things you can do. I'm eating, you know, nicotine lozenges all day. I drink a lot of coffee. I'm no stranger to porn.
Hey, there's three bottles of different types of vodka in my freezer right now.
Yeah,
I have not been an alcoholic, but I'm taking a hard look at it right now.
Don't do that.
It's like a car it's like a nice car, and I'm going to go drive that for a little bit, see how that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, no,
you know?
Yeah, you don't want to go down that hole.
But
not
Mark,
at, not
you
at
feel,
this age.
You feel better, Mark. You do.
For a split second.
No, sometimes it lasts all evening. Yeah, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, that's the same logic that thinks, well, there's always
but
vodka.
Is that? But that's always, that's another.
Well, okay, you know, shit doesn't feel good all the time. It's not all about you feeling good. You know, sometimes, feeling the pain.
I have to feel this right now.
Yes. How many times have I told you that? You have to feel this. And you want it to change immediately, and you want it to be better right now. And that's
I'm
how
like
you
Archie.
Always...
I'm all in the family when Edith was going through menopause, and Archie looks at her and goes, "If you're going to change, go change now, and we're done with it."
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no, the thing is like, and it's the other thing I learned from this last heartbreak is that, you know, when you're in this shit, even if it's not that, you know, dramatic, is that look at your life. Shit fades, dude. You know, it just fades. It's the emotional importance of things diminishes over time. You know, not your wiring. I mean, you know, dealing with, you know, being 2 years old emotionally, you know, that's kind of wired in. But heartbreak, disappointment, you know, illness, you know, loss, you know, we're people. We're designed to handle it. And all of that, when you're in the middle of it, is like, oh, well, this is never going to
happen. I'm going to feel this way for the rest of my life.
And if you really look back at your life, you don't.
Yeah.
It just, you know, some woman came up to me last night and she goes, "You remember me?" And I'm like, "I know." You know, what happened exactly and how long ago was it?
Was I nice or yeah, or
right,
bad?
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, she said, "No, the last time you were here or, you know, whenever the hell that was, you know, I met you with a friend and, you know, we went out and we had a burrito and then you went to a bar with us and then you made out with my friend." And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, so everything that seems, you know, very important, it tempers itself over time and it just becomes an experience and it becomes literally the most horrible parts, you know, things that have happened to your life. You, at a certain age, you could actually have this reaction to them when someone reminds you, you could actually go, "Oh yeah.
How is she?
Yeah, I remember that."
Oh, yeah,
yeah, you remember you were on the bridge? Not really. I don't remember being on the bridge. Was I on the bridge?
Hey, wait a minute. The bridge. Okay. And yeah.
And you helped me off. Yeah, okay, sure. We had lunch. I remember the lunch.
Great lunch. We had bisque.
Yeah.
Remember the bisque?
Yeah, yeah.
Remember the lobster bisque? I don't feel like we've talked about anything about his podcast like I wanted to.
We don't
to.
Have to talk about his That's podcast. All right. I was going to talk about his cats.
Oh, he's upset about you're well, upset Boomer, about your cats right now too.
Yeah, well, there's loss, you know, and and with a cat, there's hope. You know, I don't know. He was an outdoor cat. He sort of had to be an outdoor cat because he peed on everything, but it took a long time to actually exile him. You know, it's weird when you have an animal. And I talk about this on stage sometimes, that when you have a cat that does that, but you love the cat, it's amazing what you have to what has to happen in order for you to actually take action against that cat. Or anyways, for me, like either friends have to come over and walk into your house and within 2 seconds go, what the fuck? Did a giant cat pee on your house? What's going on in here? And then like a moron, you go, I don't even smell it.
You know, what's going on?
And then you know, at some point you'll be sniffing around going, it's right around here. And then you'll smell your shirt and go, oh, my God, he peed on me. I don't know when that happened. He's got to go outside. But Boomer was, I mean, there were strays around. There was a competition out there. And, you know, he was having a hard time, I think. And, you know, I didn't know what to really do. They weren't beating him up. But, you know, there are coyotes in my neighborhood. But these two strays, there was a deaf black cat that lives, in my neighborhood that I feed, and it lives. A deaf cat. You imagine how tough that cat has to be?
That cat is tough.
Deaf. And it's a horrifying thing to hear a deaf cat meow because it has no gauge. Oh. It's like, yeah! Yeah, it's just like, it's weird. It's a very scary cat. But I don't know. I'd like to think that Boomer just went somewhere where someone let him in. And maybe if there, I have two other cats, maybe he's living with some, I'd like to think, nice lady who's giving him wet food, which I didn't. And there's no other cats for him to compete with. And he's not peeing on her shit. And if I find that lady, I'm taking my fucking cat.
Going right in.
Yeah, but we're dealing with the loss. The backyard's a little sad, but it's animals. It's animals.
So what makes you a cat guy versus a, Chick's more of a dog guy?
I'm like a dog guy.
I just don't have, I don't want anything needier than me in my house. You know, it's just, cats are, they are their own thing and, they're fine without you. I don't want the responsibility. I grew up with dogs all over the place. We had several old English sheepdogs throughout my life, and my dad showed them at one point in time. And I have a childhood covered, with hair and cleaning up shit, and with volatile thoroughbred dogs. And I just in the life I live, I would do a disservice to a dog. My yard's not really compatible, and I don't have a lot of time. And cats are they're just easier. They're just easier, and I find them sort of fascinating. I like the fact that they don't really like you. That like somebody, even Boomer, with a 10-year past, it's not unusual for a cat to go, this food's better, I'm taking off.
Get the highway.
Yeah. Thanks for the help.
If you had to look back on this on your podcast, and I have a favorite, and I'm going to tell you, it's a two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
It's you and Louie.
Mm-hmm.
Because much like today's podcast, I thought that one was, I think they're all very good, obviously, but that one was really real, and you guys were repairing some things, and I got the sense that he was mad at one point, then I got the sense you were mad at one point.
Well, Louie and I, it's weird with comics because, we're sort of like, we're kind of lone wolves, in general. We all know each other, and we have a shorthand, and it's a real brotherhood of incredibly selfish people.
Yeah.
But we do take care of each other. When it comes right down to it, we look out for each other. We respect the fact that this community, there's subsets and there are people that, one person will think is a real comic or whatever the case, whatever it is. Louis and I had known each other for many years, for 20 some odd years. And he was one of those guys in my life early on. He was always more successful than me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I first moved to New York in the late 80s, he was already, making money at clubs that I couldn't get into. And it was always
crashing his motorcycle.
Oh, yeah. The motorcycle crash. Well, he was like that guy. And I would never had the balls to be that guy. But Louis, he's slightly, you wouldn't know that about him, but he was a crazy fucking kid. And he was a kid. He's younger than me. And when he started, he was in his teens. But, he was the kid that would drive 150 miles an hour. He was the kid who would, buy things on credit cards with money he didn't have. He would, run the motorcycle up FDR. I mean, he was always pushing the envelope in very dangerous ways, and he's been very lucky in his life with that. And eventually that settled down and took a different type of, trouble. But for me, he was always a guy that really, and to this day, you know, there's only a few guys that you're going to meet in your lives that can genuinely make you laugh at yourself and also sort of disarm whatever, you know, your anxiety you're having. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I've always loved comedy, watching comedy, is that, like, you know, these guys seem to have a handle on shit, and they can sort of diminish the panic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like with a laugh, like, oh, I do that, you know, or oh, it's not that big a deal. You know, that's what comics provide people. But so Louis and I had known each other for years, and I would consider him a good friend. You know, I was at his wedding but we didn't talk that much. But whenever we did, we sort of laid it out, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, I'm fucking, blah, 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 blah. You know, he's got a limit to what he'll listen to. you know, he's usually pretty precise in his response to mm-hmm. my emotional needs. And it's only going to go so far.
Is he emotionally? I get the feeling he's like emotionally on top of it and healthy and.
Well, what he does, which is really sort
I do
of,
really I feel like it,
just the opposite.
Like just void of emotion.
Oh no, I don't think that's true. I think Louis is he's constantly doing some sort of mathematics in his head about, you know, how to deal with life, like mm-hmm. And we talked about that, but the reason the schism came is that, you know, I started to think, like, you know, I'm just, you know, like he needs people conditionally, you know, when he's, you know, upset about something and but you know, the truth of the matter is I'm like that too. And most selfish people are like that. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, my resentment overrode the fact that I couldn't just acknowledge that the fucking guy is busy. Like, this is the first time I've really been busy in my life, and people email me and I'm like, I can't, I'm not. You know, like I forget to get back to them. I can't, you know, I get a text and like in 3 days later, I'm like, oh shit. And it's not because I have any problem with that person. Like I got fucking things going on.
Well, I told you this. That's the favorite part. One of my favorite many parts of that episode is when you said, Louis, I emailed you. I called you. Why didn't you email me back? And he goes, I didn't want to talk to you.
I took some hits.
yeah.
But what were you saying? Well, you know, I don't want to talk about, you know, Louis's emotional disposition. But the thing that he always did that was interesting is, like, Louis has a very hungry brain, you know, and you know, a pretty, you know, hungry heart, and like he would read big things, like he'd read biographies of Churchill, you know, he would research, like he would glean life advice, you know, like, you know, you could be talking to him about, like, you know, eating, and he'd be like, well, you know, Abraham Lincoln. You know, like he's like, so
not as a bit, but no, as no, an actual no, fact.
Right. Yeah. He would take the experience of great men and sort of, you know, find life lessons in it.
Yeah.
And like I just texted him yesterday because, you know, we do talk, but, you know, I understand that we're both busy and I don't mm-hmm. have expectations anymore. But our friendship is better. You know, I go to New York. Usually what we'll do. Is he'll say, like, come over, and I'll go over and we'll fucking lay it out. We'll talk. You know, he'll show me what he's working on. He'll talk about himself for a long time, and then I'll get a few words in, and I feel
good. And you feel good.
Yeah, that's the way it works. But he's very concise, and I love him. You know, and I always have, and I think that the interesting thing about that episode was that, you know, the way I framed that episode outside of repairing the relationship was. There were these moments, and you hear him in that, in, mm-hmm. in that I was present for. That I don't even know. I quite honestly, I don't think he remembered that right. that I was present for them. Yeah. You know, when he found that video of Putney Swope in that bin at Blockbuster, and he didn't have any credit to rent, so he bought this movie that changed the way he looked at everything. Mm-hmm. And then the thing with the computer, and then these other moments in his life that I was, when I was thinking about Louis' career and everything else, I had this personal sort of index of, like, well, I think I was there for that.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there was the computer story when we found that computer in the garbage. I think he had sort of excised me out of that event, you know, like he remembered the event, but I think he had told the story before, and it was like, oh, you were there. You were there.
You were there.
But look, that I do that too. But the thing about the relationship is that you know, there's just rare people in your life that can disarm. I used to do a bit about it on stage about, like, and it was sort of it was a great example of the dynamic, because I think that for years he, you know, and I realized this during that interview, that he saw me as, and we're comics, so we see a lot of psychological manifestations of the human animal. Mm-hmm. I think he thought I was a loose cannon. I was in trouble. I was not destined to sort of surface. That I was like always anxious and angry and like he had sort of held me in that. Like, you know, Mark's, you know, he's got a big bag of, you know.
Oh, Mark.
Almost like that. But like he, you know, we liked each other and we were friends. But I think he sort of like, he's a bit much, you know, and I don't have a lot of time for that necessarily. But he was always there for me. But there was this one time I was living in New York. It was like 89, and I was living in a studio apartment in Alphabet City, and you know he was working and doing well, and I was just me, I called him up and I'm like, Lou, it's Mark, it's Mark, I've been up for an hour, I've drank a pot and a half of coffee, I've smoked 12 cigarettes, I've masturbated twice, and I've eaten an entire pie. What the fuck am I doing? And there's a silence on the phone, and then Louis goes, "What kind of pie?"
Of course.
And that was it. So it's really, that's been our relationship when it's good. It's really, what kind of pie? Yeah. And, but like I texted him yesterday about like, there's, a lot of things going on for me, and I'm nervous about how to respond to people, attacking me or dragging me into
now,
fights. And
that's another thing. You are, I don't know how often you do it anymore, but you are, and we're, Jess and I are familiar with it. Jason isn't on Twitter, but you, and we get irritated by, you wouldn't believe how, and I don't know why I don't respond, but man, I want to, but you have, on Twitter, you've really responded and kept it going and really laid into some people.
Yeah, but it doesn't, Louis, again, was he just, he's the amazing thing about him, and the reason why he's successful, other than he's really one of the few people I know that is possessed by a certain genius and a freedom of mind to commit to a vision that is completely unique. Mm-hmm. But as a person that lives life, he's very much about figuring out a way to move through it, without without being ripped apart by it,
right?
Because he's just like us in a lot of ways. But he draws from history and experience.
He has perspective, and
he does. He really does. And like he just said, well, look, you just got to not do it. You can't
respond.
Just don't. And you just got to figure out how to do that. But the thing that makes me do it is the thing that you and I share, which is like, that guy just hurt me.
He hurt me. I'm hurting.
Yeah. Right, and then you go, fuck you. And they go, ha ha. And that's it.
She retweeted something great the other day about a comment, reading comments. And
just don't.
Yeah.
Comment boards, I don't do that
don't
much.
Read a comment once. Shame on you. Read a comment twice. I don't even know what to do with you.
Yeah. I have a little comment board on my site, and even that, no one even goes to that site that much. I just have it, because I want to have the podcast and my comedy represented, but it's not a hub. But there is a comment board, and even there, where there's like literally a handful of commenters, there's like three or four just complete douchebags. Like everyone knows this, that the internet is just filled with, that's all it's for, is for people to be assholes.
You've had Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner and Dick Van Dyke and on and on and on. Do you have anybody that you... on your get list that you would love to have on that you can't?
I'm a little hung up on. I'm trying to get at Bob Newhart in terms of the older guys, and Checky Green would be fun. I haven't had time to really pursue some of the people I want. Iggy Pop is somebody I'd like to talk to.
He scares me in that one commercial he's in.
Well, he's kind of a scary guy, but he's a real unique, authentic bit of business, that guy.
Yeah.
And, I know that he can be a very difficult interview. Musicians are tricky because, they don't really need to talk. But I think that, I think he'd be interesting. I haven't talked to people like Will Ferrell and, some of the bigger, current comedy stars. There's definitely people I'd like to talk to that have eluded me.
Which one was the first one that you go, what? He's coming over? What? He really is?
Yeah, that happens a lot. That still happens. I think that when Ben Stiller came over, I'm like, wow, this is something. He's coming to my garage. And then, when Conan came over, that was the biggest one. Like, when I asked Conan to do it on his show and he agreed, and then he came over to my little house and sat in my garage, I was like, this is something.
That
was pretty amazing. But I've had a lot of people in there, Shanling, Richard Lewis, Brian Cranston.
John Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The actors are kind of funny because they're different. They're different than comedians. But when Cranston came over, he's like, "So this is it, huh?" And I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." John Hamm came. He's like, "Oh yeah, Hamm was over here. Yeah, Hamm was
here." Cranston seems like he has he was on Malcolm in the Middle too, but he's a really good sense of humor.
He's got a good sense of humor, but also, like, you know, I really wanted to interview Walter White. And,
you had an expectation. I think anybody who loves the show.
And it was sort of bizarre for me. I was very nervous and I didn't know how to approach him really. Cause he was Walter White to me and I didn't watch Malcolm in the Middle. So he really is just Walter White to me.
Right.
But, you know, and the weirdest thing was, is I was really kind of nervous and he turned out to be very interesting in that he's really, he sees himself as sort of a proletariat actor. Like he's a working actor. He's got a lot of, you know, interesting sort of his framework of what the job of acting is. Mm-hmm. You know, his father was in the studio system. So, you know, he's just like a meat and potatoes kind of, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just going to, you know, hammer away and I've got my way of doing it. And, you know, I'm a working actor. And it was no romantic thing about it. He was very practical.
Right.
And very interesting. And, I kept, you know, fighting the urge to be like, but when you're making meth, you know, like,
and that damn Jesse, doesn't he irritate you what he does?
But the fucked up thing about how nervous I was, I grew up in Albuquerque and they shoot the show in Albuquerque and I didn't even bring it up. It left my mind. I didn't even bring up the one thing that I could have bonded with him about personally, which is my hometown.
Right, right.
I'd forgotten.
Is there any better opening scene of a series where they're flying through the desert in Winnebago and the shirt flies out of the window and
that whole show is just fucking unbelievable. And that's like, you know, like with my show, you know, like I my own insecurity. I think we did a great job with the series with Marin. And I think it represents me well, but it's hard not to be like, but there's some amazing television on. You know, I'm just wandering around in my life, you know, aggravated and complaining and dating.
How could this be on TV?
Yeah, right? It's just like, but you know, you do what you do. You know, you do what your creativity is going to drive you to do.
And you did 10 episodes and it starts May 3rd?
Yeah. And and I have a book coming out April 29th. Well, it can be a lot of me in the world.
Speaking of those things, you know, obviously you've become a good interviewer, and I think recently you've had to do some interviews with other people as the interviewee.
Yeah.
Do you flip a switch and
I just like to talk.
Yeah.
Because I think today you did both. You interviewed us for a little bit,
yeah.
which I liked. It was very helpful, but you were very accommodating and forthcoming.
Yeah, I see it all. Like, you know, I don't, when people talk about me as an interviewer, like there's no better interviewer. It's like, I don't even write questions down. You know,
those are the best interviews.
Well, I just see them as conversations and they're going to go either way. Yeah, you know, they're going to go how they're going to go. And it's a matter of listening. And also it's a matter of empathetic listening, which I don't think I was capable of that well before the interview, before I, you know, sort of did a lot of WTFs and got my own shit straight to where like you can sense if you're listening closely enough and you can feel the emotions, like you can honestly feel the emotions of what's being talked to you about, then you can sort of ask the questions that will move more into whatever you have a little more, you just get a sense of where the next question goes and how far people are going to go in that and or not. You know, sometimes people don't talk about emotional things at all. I'm fine. I don't mind laughing. Like I can sit there and laugh at someone who's doesn't want to go into whatever. Like that's the one thing that bothers me about my show for a while there. It was like, well, yeah, people come on your show and cry. Like, because Louis got choked up, you know,
right,
I got to deal with Bobby Slayton coming in my garage going, you're going to make me cry like CK? Is this where I cry like CK? Am I going to cry like CK?
Fucking Bobby Slayton.
And, you know, that's not really what it's about. It's just about, you know, engaging in some sort of authentic conversation for at least 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, like if I can get, like I interviewed Nick Cave recently and I haven't put it up yet. And I had a hard time with him. Mm-hmm. You know, somehow or another, like I do pretty well with musicians and they're not generally easy.
So he was just not.
Well, I'm getting a lot of musicians and I like music. So like I'm excited. I had Huey Lewis on recently. Like, and it's not.
Huey's supposed to be coming around actually very soon. Yeah.
And, you know, it's not necessarily that, you know, he was my cup of tea or I was a huge Huey Lewis fan, but he's fucking Huey Lewis.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got a story and he's a real guy.
He's one of the guys with one of the albums that it was unfucking believable.
Yeah. And a lot of times people with these dudes, like one of the things that's happening lately is anybody you can go like, oh, what's that guy been doing? I want to talk to them because it's a curious thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times those guys, they've been doing a lot. You know, it's just because they never lived, you know, they never reached the height of public success that they once had, they don't just disappear and stop. Right. Sometimes they're doing the best work they've ever done.
Yeah.
You know, and no one knows anymore because they're not, you know, relevant to, like they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But where did I start this? Oh, with Swayton, authentic conversation. Oh, Nick Cave. So if I, like in my mind, if there's one moment there, if there's 5 minutes or 3 minutes that is so undeniably genuine or kind of mind-blowing, you know, that's enough for the hour. You know, yeah. And I also have to detach from my own feelings about an interview. If I didn't get what I needed personally or right. emotionally at an interview, I just keep my mouth shut because, you know, people have a relationship with this guest. They, you know, people have never heard this guy talk. People who love him have never heard him say anything. Mm-hmm. So why am I going to go like, nah, I didn't think it was that great? You know, am I going to say that? I'm going to diminish it?
Right.
You know, I had some issues with the James Franco episode that I put up the other day. You know, I had him on a live one.
I haven't had that one's very recent.
Yeah, it was a live one, and it got uncomfortable because you know.
Oh, that's South by Southwest.
Yeah, yeah, and I was making light of something, and he was just difficult. And I entered with complete open mind and heart, and I wanted to talk to him about art, but I did have my own opinions of him and how seriously he takes him. Mm-hmm. And then I made a joke at the end, and people said I was being condescending. I'm like, look, he was not easy. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do what I'm going to do. But with Nick Cave, like, it wasn't that he was bad, but, you know, if people who have a persona or a disposition that they maintain mm-hmm. sort of on purpose, you know, whether it's, you know, intentional or it's just the way they are, some people don't want to talk about their shit, you know, especially, mm-hmm. you know, British people, Australian people, you know, I don't want to generalize, but I've had some British people on that are very candid, but there's a cultural difference in my language. You right. know, if you don't respond to neurotic Jew charm pressing for your childhood memories, we're going to have a little bit of a problem.
There's going to be an issue.
He threw in charm.
Yeah,
that was charm. Yeah.
But, you know, but Cave was a little cagey, but, you know, and a little defensive. But, you know, ultimately he told this story. He's Australian. And, you know, I listen to his music. You know, that's the other thing about musicians. It's like I get panicky. Like, you know, I like this guy, but I've only listened to a couple records. He's got 20 out. Do I have to sit and listen to all 20? Is that going to bring anything to the... I can't tell you how many full catalogs of musicians' work I have bought to prepare for interviews.
And then
I'm just sitting there trying to dump a lifetime's work into my head. And it doesn't matter. You're not going to go record for record. You're like, that guitar riff you did on the first album. You know, you're going to respond to what you respond to. And if you like him, you like him. And I like Nick Cave. But he told the story about... you know, he knows Russell Crowe. They're kind of buddies. You know, Australians.
Okay.
And Russell, you know, and Nick's a writer. And Russell had told him that he wanted to do a sequel to Gladiator. And
but he dies in Gladiator.
Well, that's what Nick said, because he asked Nick Cave, you know, to give it a crack, if he wanted to give it a crack and do a screenplay for the new Gladiator. And Nick said, well, he dies. He goes, yeah, you can work with it. Yeah, figure something out.
It'd have to be a prequel.
Yeah. No. It wasn't. It was actually better than that. And I'm not going to give you any more. People can look forward to to that episode, because the story that Nick Cave wrote, the screenplay he wrote, was spectacular. And my point is that, you know, that story was enough to carry the hour for as far as I'm concerned. Even if there was 50 minutes of me struggling to get through, which were good, and we got some good information. Right. But that story was like, great. Hey, look, here's my girlfriend. Let's do it on mic real quick.
What are you doing?
Hey, baby. Hello? Hey, honey. Look, I'm on the mic. I'm about to get off this podcast. I'll call you back in a second. All right. I love you. Okay. So we got to stop. I got to call her.
Easier said than done. Here we go. We're stopping. Thank you, Mark, very much.
Thank you, you guys.
Don't ever
great.
Stop doing the podcast, okay? You promise?
I promise.
All right. Thank you, Jess.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jason.
Glad I could be here.
Boomer lives. Good night, everybody!